Oh, Quinn, I just was at Lowe's because I'm leaving at 5 in the morning tomorrow.
Wait.
Stupid. I have so much to do, and I'm having a friend stay at my place, which is, I love the idea that I have a home that I can allow people to stay at. Like, I'm actually, and I'm really excited for my friend to come from LA and stay at my place. And I had to get a lockbox to give the key to them, right? Uh-huh. And so I ordered from Amazon yesterday, and it was coming today, and then it didn't show. It's a day late and a dollar
damn
short.
It. So you had to run around so that was, and deal.
So that was $16. And then I went on Lowe's, and I found one for $20. And I was like, great. I go to Lowe's. It's not in stock. I had ordered it online.
Oh, my God. You really had a...
And then the next cheapest one was $40.
Ugh.
So I had to buy it.
Oh, man.
Isn't that gross?
Well, it'll be a really good lockbox.
Fucking hell. Hi, how are you?
Hi. I'm good. We just went to Botanic Garden and just like enjoyed some cherry blossoms and some tulips.
So you had like a little bit of a different sort of vibe than I did today?
I did just different. Well, I was with my family, so I don't know. So probably the same.
I was able to listen to a podcast. I actually,
right.
Like, you know.
You probably had a more relaxing time than I did. The kids were pretty good, all told. Yeah, it's been like a whirlwind weekend, and we went to the dodgeball party, and Matt and another dad, Jonathan,
sprained
just like
their
play. They played dodgeball so hard. They were like, they played grown-ups versus kids, and it was like 4 grown-ups and 20 kids, and they were playing so hard and so competitively, and had like this shit-eating grin like on their faces, to where I'm like, why really aren't the grown-ups like saying what they need, which is like dodgeball birthdays? Like, these dads
I think
need to
out
admit
what Matt's birthday is this year.
I'm like, you guys should just admit what you want.
Was he just like attacking children? Was it like,
yes, hitting kids in the face with dodgeballs? It was very intense. It
was very were all intense. The kids and parents consenting to this?
I didn't pay close attention because I blew up one of those like air couches. And then just like sat on it with the moms and was like, come sit on my couch, and just like held port on my couch.
Is the air, you had port?
No, it's the kind you run. You like run and catch air and it turns into a little couch.
So it looks like a vagina?
Yeah.
I know exactly the kind.
Yeah.
I know exactly.
It's really good. It really works. So we were kind of just sitting on the couch chatting. Oh, and then it was so funny. And then I got to tell you this story because I know you love this little girl, which is to say, I took Frances to the bathroom with me, and we were chatting on our way to and from, and I was talking to her, and I knew she'd had some people over at her house the night before, and I was like, what'd your mom make for dinner? And she goes, oh, and one thing I love about Frances is she has like a high appreciation of food. Like she doesn't eat like most kids. She'll eat like real foods.
She like, I met her the first time when she was eating ramen, and she's like, this is the best ramen in the neighborhood. She was 7.
So she was like, she goes, I said, what'd your mom make for dinner? And she goes, oh, it was so great. Rice, chips, guacamole, Cinco de Mayo.
I see her.
I died.
She gives me the biggest
Cinco
hug every
de
time.
Mayo.
Every time I see her, she's like, hey. And she gives me a hug like we're old. Like she gives me a hug as old friends do.
Yes.
It's not like a kid butt out hug. It's not like, some of my favorite hugs are Griffin and Frida, besides my nephews, of course. But like Frida will hold on to me, and I practice the Disney hug where I don't let go.
Mm-hmm.
And then Frida holds on to me for minutes.
So long.
Like a
so
really
cute.
Long. It's so cute. And I just like getting a hug from Griffin because it's like I got a hug from Griffin. I feel like I won the day.
I know. He's hard to get.
But I got him. That sounds so fun.
And I left from dodgeball and went and did shibori for the first time. And it's in my basement. I got to rinse it tonight and hang it and stuff. It's like,
oh,
you know, it's the indigo dyeing.
Yeah. You said it. Like, I was like, shibui. Yeah. Yeah. Shibui.
Yeah. So that was, you know, we'll see how it ends up turning out, but it looked really cool. The thing I like about that craft is you don't really need a planner to know what you're doing, and you can never guess what it'll look like. And then at the end of the day, it looks really cool. So you feel really good constantly, like you're making good choices, even though you're not really even making choices.
Mm,
it's a good craft.
What did you make? A handkerchief or like?
I did a handkerchief for a bonnet for Koa.
Thank you for making him a bonnet.
And I did a button-up shirt for me, a tank for me. And then I liked doing it so much. I did kind of a weird move in company I didn't know well, which was I suddenly decided to take off my shoes and socks and try to do my socks. And then I came home with just shoes. Well, and then Becca and I called a car, and then our car showed up, and it had rainbow lights all over the outside and on the inside, like it was a limo, even though it wasn't. And then when we got in, there was rainbow flashing lights and a mist machine inside the car. I was like, what's happening?
You got upgraded, baby. You got upgraded to a black. And that was an Uber black. That's incredible. Oh my God, I'm excited to see your craft.
Yeah, I'm excited to show you. It turned out pretty good. And I just love crafting.
Crafting is good. I need to do it more.
It's so good for your brain, and it's so good to do it away from your kids where
you can focus on you're
like
doing
oh
it.
Like
it's you
I'm
actually
just
crafting.
Yeah, like I'm just being creative because I like doing crafts with my kids, but a lot of the times it's more scaffolding than it is crafting. Like I'm not sure what I would do creatively if I weren't with them, and so it's like nice to be an independent crafter in the world.
I feel like there's an analogy there about being a mother in general.
Yeah,
of
for
like
sure.
What it is of being, yes, I'll find it later.
Such a long weekend back. Then we like get in bed and we're going to bed and it's so late, and Ko is like, we were talking about something, and Griff was like, well, that's really sad. And Griff and Ko goes, the lights are out, like you have to know, like it's bedtime. Matt is lying with Griff on the bottom trundle to paint a picture, and I'm with Ko on the top, and the lights are out, and we're like lying with them. Griff's like, oh, that's really sad. And Ko goes, you want to hear something really sad? Have you ever heard of the Twin Towers? And I'm like, what? And then Matt's like, do we? And I was like, what do you know about that, Koa? And he's like, can I tell the story?
Because you guys never told him anything.
Right. Mm-hmm. So I was like, just out of like, I was too curious to prevent it from happening. So I was like, go ahead. And he's like, there's these two big buildings in New York City. They were filled with people, and lightning struck both of them. And there was just silence in the room. And then he goes, that's right, isn't it? And Matt and I were like, well, some of it's right. Okay, it's time for bed.
It's like, ah! Close your eyes. Close your eyes. Shut your mouth and close your eyes. Wow.
So it was just a long weekend
and
with a lot of feelings,
and this was the
hopes,
day before
dreams.
We worked on the 76th floor of the World Trade Center, correct?
Correct.
Nailed it.
That's
really?
Just what
Do
you want
knew?
Your child to remind
Do you, think
you
he,
of.
Like, knew?
No. No. I wasn't going to be
kids
like,
magic,
and by the way,
though.
That's where I'm headed. Like,
well,
I.
No. Are you kidding? Hello,
I did
anxiety.
End up telling him a little bit more because he asked later, and I was like, so here's what happened. And he goes, wow. Cole will always be like, wow, that is sad. I'm like, oy. Am I doing this right, this parenting thing?
You
we'll
are.
See.
And what's great is his reaction is totally, it's totally fine.
Yeah,
it's
totally.
Great. His reaction is exactly appropriate.
Okay.
Exactly appropriate. He's a kid. He's putting it together in his brain. Oh, God.
I wanted to hear about what you did on your birthday.
Oh my God. Well, what did I do on my birthday? I fucking smoked Disney.
Disney.
I really got Disney hard. So the day before, so I was in Disney World with my family, and it was such a wonderful vacation. It was so, like, I went, my parents, like, really gave us an incredible vacation. My issue with Disney is that you have to like plan, or you feel like you have to plan.
You can't sort of just take it moment to moment.
Yeah. I mean, I would have
liked
to. I think
that's the argument for moving to Florida and becoming a legitimized Disney adult is like, just get the year pass, take every day as you'd like.
I mean, the amount of walking.
Just live there.
My nephews are 5 and 6. Someone was like, you should bring a stroller. And we were like, they're 5 and 6. Thank God we had the stroller. I was sad we didn't have 3 seats in a stroller. We had 2 seats. So my poor brother had my little nephews on his shoulder. Like, and I was holding my nephews because they were tired. And I'm like, we got to make these rides. So my sister and I sort of like spearheaded the like lightning lane, which again, like I want to acknowledge the privilege of being able to have access to that, which feels, again, like I said it, capitalism is popping off right now, you guys. It is going hard. And Disney, but what I loved about Disney and why I understand a little bit about Disney adults, you had spoken a little bit when you went about how accessible it is for kids.
Mm-hmm.
While I love that, I think what brought me so much joy was that the whole place is just to have fun. The whole place is just for joy. That's it. That's all we're doing there, is we're just giving you a good time.
Yeah.
And I think that felt so exciting.
It's a great thesis statement.
It's an incredible thesis statement. And I was with my nephews and they saw like there was all these cool things. So we went on like every ride. So the first day we went on we went to Magic Kingdom. We did it all. We did Dumbo. We did Barnstormer. We did Peter Pan. We did the Seven Dwarves. And my nephew, Jack, was like, I love screamy rides. That was his deal. He's like, I love a screamy ride. And he loved it. And I was very lucky to be on the like front row with him in a lot of these. And his face is just like, did I send you all the pictures yet of the roller coasters?
No.
I didn't send you any? Okay, I want to send you them because they make me like so happy. There's one of my whole family on Tiana's Bayou.
And oh, you did send me that. That one's cute.
That one made me really happy. This is the one I went on with Jack. Ew. Like, look at his face. He's screaming and loves it so much. And then little Liam is so cute. And then in the next one we took, so we did Screamy Rides. The next day, we went to Animal Kingdom, and we started off with Dinosaur, which is a ride they wanted to go on.
Uh-huh.
We went on Dinosaur. I just sent you that picture.
Yeah. Looks like one of them didn't do too well.
He's fully covering his eyes. All three boys have vastly different reactions.
You can tell in that picture. It's very clear.
It's very clear he didn't like it. And it is a screamy ride, but it was pretty dark. So he's like, I did not like that ride. So then we were kind of moving and grooving through the park, and my brother was like, let's go on Everest. So we get on Everest, and Everest is a full-on roller coaster.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting next to Tommy, and he legitimately, like, it made my heart so, because I love roller coasters. I love them. So we're all on it together. I'm with Tommy, and he just gets quiet, and his face gets like, and I'm like, you got to scream. Like, scream with me. And it was dark. It went backwards. It was too much. And then we did Flight of
Passage.
That's
what Koa does when it's too much, too. Like, dead silent, white as a sheet.
It's worse. It's, like, worse than crying.
And you're
worse.
Like, oh, are you dead? It's so scary.
I just kept saying, it's going to be over soon, I promise. And he was like, I'm never doing that again.
Never, ever.
This was on my birthday, so it was really... But then we went to Flight of Passage, which was like a 3D Avatar. And some of my nephews were like pretty upset about Everest still. They didn't want to go on. But you sit in like almost like a... I'm telling too much about rides. I'm hearing myself and I'm saying too much about rides.
No. Everyone loves a ride. You're fine.
I want to say...
Be yourself.
I had an amazing... My favorite was my little nephew. Liam was in it. And the chair sort of like gets you in before you have your 3D and you go on this ride of a banshee in Pandora. And there were some scary bits, but the machine like closes on your back to sort of snug you in so you can feel like you're on a breathing animal is what it does. Like where you're at, where you're straddling, it like feels like you're on an aminal. Which is
an aminal,
cool.
Yeah.
But it like pushes behind you, and all of a sudden I hear my little nephew go, ooh, it's like a massage chair. I really
so
like
cute.
That. But it was an amazing, vacation. It was a lot of hard work in terms of just like, it's hot, it's like, you know, but it was, they did a great job.
Mm-hmm.
And my parents, it was so nice. We went to, on my birthday lunch, we went to Woody's Roundup Rodeo,
mm-hmm.
which was in Hollywood Studios. And it was pretty cute. It was like a barbecue theme. But the best part was that there were no characters there. But the best part was that they like, there was a voiceover that was like, and toys beware. Like the premise is you're in Andy's toy box.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would tell you that Andy or a kid is coming, and they, everybody in the restaurant had to freeze. Like, oh, toys.
I really like that.
It was so, and all the kids were like fully frozen.
The idea that like, it was magical. It's like, that's why Disney's so cool, is they will get everyone to buy in as well.
Yeah.
So it's and a vibe of like, we're in. Yes. It's like, yeah, I just like they get people to play.
That's
Disney.
I mean, that's what
you
my,
may
that's
be
the
anti-Semitic and not like me, but I like you.
I mean, we went
the
to
feelings,
Star Wars,
not mutual,
which was great.
Walt.
We went to Rise of the Resistance, which was amazing. I'm so glad we went on that.
So good.
Yeah, it was
sounds
so
like you
fun.
Had a great trip.
I was so exhausted by the end. I have this new thing in my feet. Dear readers, write in if you have this, where I feel the nerve on the ball of my foot whenever I walk, and it numbs my toes. And so this is like kind of a new fun thing. I think I turned 36.
Okay.
And
fun.
Now walking is hard.
Welcome.
What the fuck?
It just gets like, worse right
fuck.
Now. Yeah.
Fuck.
So
I'm like,
many
have
things
to wear
are wrong.
Slippers. I have to wear like house shoes to support my feet now. And I love, I had this feeling where I was like, I love being barefoot and I having a hard time walking barefoot at my home.
Yeah.
That's pretty fucked up.
Sorry to say it's not going to get better.
Shut up. By the way, you're listening to Truly.
Darkly.
Creepily.
At Ritual, Mother's Day is kind of a big deal, and we're celebrating accordingly. Find your ritual. If mom needs a bit of stress relief, digestive support, or is looking to support glowy, smooth skin, do it today with 40% off your first month for a limited time at ritual.com/podcast. That's ritual.com/podcast for 40% off your first month. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Should we tell stories?
Yes, I go first.
Do it.
I have a really exciting story. It's actually not an exciting story, but it's
a weird pick.
It is
an
exciting.
Let me tell you this
really
boring story that I found.
No, exciting feels like the wrong, because there's going to be a lot of bad things that happen in it, but it ends in a fun, no, that's not what I want to say either. Okay, so I'm just going to tell you the story. I got it from Wikipedia, and then I watched a documentary on Netflix called Indian Predator, A Murder in a Courtroom.
Okay.
So I'm going to take you to India in a place called, oh, fuck. We're off to a great start. At the Kasturba Nagar. This is the area in India. You hear heard of it? Know it?
Well.
It's not a very well-off place. And there's this guy, Aku Yadav, who is, let's not beat around the bush here. This guy sucks. He is a really bad fucking guy. But think of like Christopher Waltz in Inglourious Bastards. Worse. This guy fucking sucks. In a way that like, I'm going to go through what he did, but essentially he terrorizes this area of India. And specifically
Wait,
women.
Hang on.
The earliest reported crime on this guy's record is in 1991. He's 20 years old and he's a part of a gang rape. Unfortunately, it gets worse from there. Mm. Like that's like a drop in the bucket of his crimes is what I will say. He's starting strong and it's only going to get worse. He first goes to jail. And I guess some people in the area are like, you could go to jail, you can come out a changed man, or you can go to jail and become an even more heinous criminal. And he chose the latter. He went on to rob homes. And if anyone he met along the way resisted, he would beat them senseless. He would abuse women constantly. At one point, he stole a watch from a woman who knew him. And the woman later was like, I saw you. The watch is missing. Do you have any idea where it is? And he's like, why are you asking me? And she's like, I just feel like it was there before. And then when you were there, it stopped being there. And the right, just the right math of that is you took it.
Call me crazy.
And so then he beat her husband and in a rage, like took a glass and like smashed it, cut his hand. And this woman who just was like, you stole this watch from me. He just rubbed blood all over her walls while she like bandaged it up. Like absolutely insane, terrorizing behavior.
Yeah.
He would take, and we're in a poor area of India, so people don't have a lot of money, but he would take their fuel money so people couldn't cook for weeks. He would, and he had a relationship with law enforcement, so he would bribe the police, he would buy them drinks, he would give them money, and convinced them to let him go and just keep committing these crimes.
Mm-hmm.
And not only did they turn a blind eye, but oftentimes they would support him. Anytime people would like levy a complaint against him, the police are like, find this person. And they go on a wild goose chase and no complaint would ever be levied. He would extort money. He would, again, harm anyone resisting him. He was using both emotional terror and physical terror.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said, like, the amount of rape and abuse that he perpetrated against women in this community is absolutely astounding. At one point, they said that it was every woman, and they will say that the age, it didn't matter how old they were. The youngest reported is 10 years old.
Oh my God.
To the old, like, he was indiscriminate about who his victims were. It was almost like an addiction. He was unmarried, and so he just chose any woman he wanted to and violated them. Women lived in terror of him. They wouldn't step foot outside. They would pee in pots in their homes so that they wouldn't make any noise. They wouldn't cook outside. They wouldn't have community. They recall him having a jacket with pockets, and in each pocket is a different weapon.
That's kind of goofy.
Very goofy. There was a story of a woman coming into her friend's house, breathing heavily, being like, he's ransacking the home next door, and just like escaping, like her life depends on it.
Mm-hmm.
And she was pregnant, and the stress of it caused her to miscarry.
Mm.
Nobody would celebrate. There were no weddings. People wouldn't come to the village because they knew of him. And again, the police were not helping. One woman, though, that he was afraid of, her name was Asha Bhagat, and she seemed to be this like small lady who also worked with some nefarious characters, but she had this power behind her, and mm-hmm. she often would keep him in his place, and she was the only person he was really afraid of, and she would speak to him in a way that he would cower around her.
Mm-hmm.
And she was known as protecting all these women, or trying to, and they referred to her as their guardian angel, and she fought for the poor, and the two of them had a rivalry, and it was intensifying. Mm-hmm. And it was growing, and at this point he does have a target on his back, and so there is a plan to murder him. So some people get him drunk, they attack him, he's really badly injured, but unfortunately he manages to escape. And in doing so, I think he becomes even more aggressive. And he meets this guy, Avinash, who's a friend to everyone in the community, including Asha. And so he's friends with Aku, and he's friends with Asha. And Aku is like, you can't hang out with her. And he's like, you can't tell me who to be friends with. And this leads to an altercation. And mm-hmm. he kills this man in broad daylight. Asha sees this. She starts yelling at him, and he responds, you're next. He ends up getting convicted of this crime of killing this man in broad daylight in front of everyone, and he gets less than 10 months in prison. And he comes out, and he's worse than before. In 1999, he's out, and he is around town, and he goes to buy some tobacco. And the local woman who owned the shop was like, this was a weird situation because he never paid for anything. And she recalls him paying 100 rupees for this tobacco. And so that was surprising that he didn't just take it. And him and a bunch of his gang members knock on Asha's door, and she's getting her hands hennaed. And a boy answers the door, or she answers the door. Asha answers the door, and there's a boy there she doesn't recognize. And he says, you know, I'm a friend of someone and I need some water. Can you get me some water? And so she goes and she gets some water. She comes out and she is attacked by all these men with weapons. Her daughter is there. She begs to let her mom go. They do not listen. Asha is mutilated. They slit her throat. They chop off her nose, her ears. They mutilate her breasts. They decapitate her. Obviously, it's Aku. He is arrested, And while he's arrested, the police let him sit comfortably in the backseat of his van. Before he's taken to the police, he's given samosas. So he's delicious. Eating samosas. Delicious. But I don't know, maybe the man who brutally murdered a woman shouldn't be getting
samosas.
Lay off
the samosas.
Or maybe the police shouldn't be like providing them to him. Sure. Just like as a, I don't know, as an idea. Especially when there's so many women who are trying to levy these complaints at the police and they are getting absolutely nowhere. There are no recorded complaints on file for him. That's how insane this is. There are stories of he would knock on a door, see a man, beat him, put him away, drag his wife, rape her. And he would do this consistently. This would be an MO of his. And what's a really hard pill to swallow in this area and in this culture, specifically in this area of India, is that oftentimes women are blamed for the abuse that is perpetrated against them.
Right.
So when women are survivors of sexual abuse or rape, oftentimes they will say, "You have disgraced our family," to the women. So in addition, women are also not reporting it, but the women that are reporting it are not being heard.
Uh-huh.
Once he had his eyes set on you, it was game over. He would take what he wanted. Mothers were terrified. Mothers were marrying their children off early to get mm-hmm. them away. They were taking their girls out of school so that this man wouldn't see them as they were walking to school.
Ugh, this is so horrible.
It's so hard because this community is trying to make complaints and they cannot. No one is listening to them. No one is helping them. And mm-hmm. in the societal aspect of it, these women are being blamed for this. It's like right. there's no winning anywhere. When husbands would go and vouch for their wives and say, "This man raped my wife," the police would say, "Your wife is having an affair with him."
Oh my God.
His friends, they interview in this documentary, they interview his friends, and his friends are like, "There were no cases against him. I don't think any of this happened," which is very frustrating because you're also hearing from survivors. In 2004, there's this woman, Usha, mm-hmm. and she is a woman who is going to school for hospitality outside, and she is dressed in a different way, and oftentimes she tries to take her uniform and put her regular clothes on, but sometimes she misses it, so she dresses a bit differently, and she catches his eye, and he starts watching her, and she knows, like, this isn't a good situation. And at one point, when she's coming home from work, her boss had asked another man to walk her home because he knew how dangerous it was, mm-hmm. and she hears this man talk about her in a really disrespectful way, and she gets very frustrated. And that night, or soon after, she's at home and she hears sort of a commotion at her neighbor's house, and she can peel out a brick of her home, and she can look out at her neighbors, and she realizes her neighbors are being abused. So the next day, Usha, who I think has, she's been exposed to other cultures, or maybe she has like a more profound, like she feels more emboldened to mm-hmm. make a statement. And she goes with her neighbor to lodge a complaint against him. Once again, the police do nothing. They send her to different officers to take her statement. No one will take it. And what's worse is they do nothing. And then they tell Aku about the complaint that she's trying to make. So now has his sights set on her.
Yeah. Yes.
And so that night she hears him and his gang coming up to her house. They are yelling. They are making a ruckus. They're on all four sides of her family's home. Now she doesn't live by herself. She lives with her family. And she, the things they are saying to her, I had mentioned what he did to Asha, and how mutilated her body was. She said that he was making threats that were worse than that, talking about exactly what he would do to her.
Mm-hmm.
And they brought acid to throw on her face, and she's with her family, and she's in her house, and she's being interviewed for this. She's amazing. And she's talking about how he's going to kill her, but she's also with her sisters and her mother and these other women, and she knows they're going to kill them. So she forces them out of the room, and they're like, we're not going to leave you. We're your family. We're here with you. And she said, no, leave. I can't have them hurt you as well. So they leave to another room. She's there figuring out what to do. And then she gets this idea where she's going to take a gas canister and she disconnects it from the stove and she brings it to her and she turns it on and she lets them know. She says, if you come into this house, you're threatening to kill me. I will blow us all up and I will not be sorry about it.
Hell yeah. I'll live and die a hero.
I'll live and die a hero. Also, I have to tell you, in this moment, he also disconnects her landline telephone. Again, the terrorism that this man is perpetrating against this community of people. And so she turns on the gas and she's about to light the match and she's screaming, help, help, help. And somehow her screams are heard by the community.
Mm-hmm.
And people suddenly open their door and flood the street with sticks and stones. Aku sees this and he runs away and people are chasing him with rocks and sticks. He jumps into sewer water and runs away. People are still on the hunt for him. They cannot find him that night, but he becomes public enemy number one. What's wild is the next day Usha gets on her moped and she goes around the community and she starts rallying support. She says things like, if you're not going to stand up now, you're never going to stand up. She rallies the troops. If not now, then when?
Yeah, what are we waiting together. For? Let's do this.
They're tracking him. They're terrorizing him. It's the first time where he has a little bit less power, where he's walking in groups and he has his shirt over his head to hide his identity.
Yeah.
They start to engage the press and they start to have a media press conference and the police are really upset. Once they do press conferences in front of the media, the police are really angry, as you know. Police don't like to be criticized for not doing their job, weirdly enough. And so the support from the community is growing, growing. They're getting louder voices. Again, this was late July that this happened to Usha. By August 6, 2004, a group of 100 people gather and they go to Aku's house and they demolish it just by rage. They take it down. They destroy everything in his house. They're like, you, no more, no more. August 7th, enough. August 7th, he knows shit's about to hit the fan. So he turns himself into the police. He's like, listen, I'm going to go spend a couple days. I'm going to get stronger. I'm going to come out. I'm going to kill them all. I'm going to be on top again. It's August 13th, 2004. It's about 3 o'clock in the afternoon and he is set to appear. It's about 3 o'clock in the afternoon and he's set to appear in court. He rolls up. He is handcuffed to another prisoner. The two of them roll up to the courthouse and all the people from his community are there. They're amongst other people near the courthouse, but like people are there and they're watching him.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not good. He sees this woman who is like seething hatred, like rage, anger. And it's the landlady of a woman who was raped. So it's one of her tenants was raped and she was so angry. And he spots her and he says, you didn't learn your lesson. And you, I'll be back to see you when I'm out. She takes her sandal and she throws it at him.
Oh my God.
At this point, chaos breaks out. They bring him into the courthouse. People pile in after him. Mm-hmm. Some say it's hundreds of people pile into the courthouse after him.
Mm-hmm.
They're coming in from the back door. They're coming in from the sides. The police are overwhelmed. They throw chili powder in his face and blind him. They start beating him. There are reports of people with knives that stab him in the rib. The knives bend, they go out, they straighten the knife, they come back in, they stab him again. The amount of collective rage in this moment is unfathomable. There are reports of the man who was handcuffed to him next to him was like, he was trying to, Aku was trying to defend himself, but the guy's like, I need to defend myself. So he was completely defenseless with one of his hands.
Mm-hmm.
And as you probably can assume, he dies. He is beaten to death. He is stabbed. He is dead. He is stabbed 73 times.
I mean,
It has left people just leave. The man, the prisoner,
sometimes
is handcuffed
you
to
reap
the body.
What you sow, buddy.
I mean, the reason I looked this story up was because I was like, what's a vigilante case? I was curious about.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
At this point, the next day, the police are trying to find who did it. And it became an I Am Spartacus moment. I think I'm using that right, where everybody.
Oh, right. Everyone's like, I did it. I did it. I did it. I did it. I did it.
Everyone said I did it. In
so
fact,
they can't do
there
shit.
There were 400 people claiming that they
so
did
like,
it.
So like, what are we going to put this whole town in jail?
Yes. And so they were like, we just need four people. And so four accused women were collected, or five, and one of them was pregnant. And what happened was, is like, one was a daughter and a mother was like, no, I did it. And it's like taking the place of her daughter. Everybody's like trying to protect each other. But it started this insane amount of protests against the police inaction, against what was happening to the women, and people weren't hearing them. The day he died, the women in the community talked about how they all had a really good feast and that they were able to be outside again and they felt free, mm-hmm. that everyone who he terrorized rejoiced in his death. After the five women were in prison, the next day more women came saying that they did it. I think 400 to 500 people surrendered themselves to the court. And then, again, the protests around the country were huge. It supported the women. The women were shown a lot of love from communities far away. The five women were released. And then the police were like, you know what? We don't think it was women. We don't think women are capable of this. We think they're covering up for men. Ooh. And so then they started looking for men, and they tried to spin a story that it was a gang rivalry that killed him. But really, I think that was just to cover up their ass. That was just to cover their asses for not doing anything. What's wild is that the trial concluded 10 years later in 2014. Of the 21 accused, 7 of them were women. 3 of the accused had died by the time the verdict was read. The judge said at the sentencing, he said, "Go, I set you all free." The 18 remaining were acquitted for lack of evidence, and the relief they all felt collectively. But again, this is a story of vigilante justice. And is it justice? I guess not. At the same time, these women were suffering, and he would have terrorized them for much longer, I'm sure. And it's just it just was an insane story. The documentary, again, I want to tell you what it is. It's called Indian Predator, A Murder in a Courtroom. And it's incredible because you hear a lot of firsthand information from these survivors and these fucking badass people who had to take matters into their own hands.
That's pretty nuts.
It's pretty gnarly.
Wow.
Yeah. It reminds me a little bit of like one of the first stories we told in Crime of a Lifetime. Do you remember?
Yeah.
Yeah, where it was like a little bit of like a revenge, like this woman became the leader of a gang in India.
Yes, yeah.
And she killed her abusers.
All right, I gotta find my story here. I got this information from just really Wikipedia because I started clicking on a bunch of articles, but it was really hard to actually read them and synthesize all the information, and Wikipedia at least did it for me in the linear way. Totally. I also read this blog, maybe it's a blog, it says thetroublewithjustice.com. This was like, and that was actually really useful too, but wow, this is a crazy story about Cindy James, who was born in Canada in 1944, one of 6 kids, and her dad's really strict. He's in the Air Force and he definitely is like a corporal punishment guy. And then she grows up and wants to be a nurse and moves to Vancouver, and her family moves to France because her dad's still in the Air Force. So they're moving around. So she'll write to them, and in collecting her letters and looking through them, people have seen that she references that she's like met someone and that she's dating them, and then that they got engaged, but then he had terminal cancer, but then he committed suicide while they were on a skiing trip. Nobody ever met him. But her letters say that happened. In the summer of 1965, she meets a guy that she'll marry named Roy Makepeace. He's not peaceful. Don't let his name fool you. He's South African.
Okay.
he's 18 years older than her, and she like says that he abuses her, and he's like, I only slapped her twice. Like, Jesus relax. Christ. So it sounds like it's going great. It's not. So she does end up divorcing him in the early 80s. And then the late 80s is when all hell breaks loose. And this is what I'm going to detail, which is her reporting 90 incidences to the police of different criminal activity that ranges from, well, maybe I won't tell you what it ranges from, and I'll just tell you about the activity. So first it's phone calls, and she's like, this person is talking in all different voices, or sometimes they're silent. And then she's like, somebody's outside my house and smashed my porch lights. And then she's like, it like escalates, of course. So then like someone threw a rock through the window, went into her house, but didn't mess with anything. And then somebody did enter the house and slashed her pillow. And then two people that are renting from her and are in the basement see stuff happen, like hear strange noises and see a man standing outside on the street. So now information has secondary sources. Then she starts dating a cop in Vancouver, and they both are like, maybe it's her ex, make peace. And one time he picks up the phone when it's ringing, and it's just silent, so I could tell it's real. And then she gets a note outside her house that says Merry Christmas with a picture of a woman with her throat slashed. And
that's not a happy greeting.
No, it's not a good Christmas card. I don't think Hallmark made it, to be fair. Then her friend Agnes Woodcock comes to her house one day and sees Cindy lying unconscious. And she wakes her up, and Cindy's like, I got attacked. Somebody came in through the garage, brought me in, and there was another person there, and they choked me, and they put a knife inside my vagina, and they said they were going to kill my sister if I reported them. Jesus. She goes in and sees a doctor, and there's no evidence of sexual assault. So she's so freaked out this is happening that she decides to move to West Vancouver. But as soon as she moves, she gets a note that says, run, rabbit, run. I'll show you how fucking good I am. Soon, bang, bang, you're dead.
Oh.
She's going to hire a PI. She hires a PI named Ozzy Caban.
Oh.
Yes. And she
Are
will
these all real people?
Pay for him to work for her for 6 years. She's paying him. It's a lot of money.
That's like having an assistant at that point. They better be booking my travel.
Because the police aren't seeing things happen, and because she's like, I was assaulted and then there's no proof and this and this and that. She's getting the feeling people don't believe her, but she's buying all this stuff. It's very real to her. She's buying pepper spray. She has a panic button. And then she starts finding dead cats in her yard that have been killed with rope.
Oh my God.
People when she's at work will get called. And if she doesn't pick up, they won't speak. So they're like, we think it's real. She'll come out to her car and messages will be on the windshield. Raw meat gets delivered to her house. So it's like everybody that gets their hands on this case feels one way and then another. Her mom's like, I don't think she's telling you the truth because she is scared. So he puts these lights at her house and gives her a radio, and the police are surveilling it. And one night he hears weird sounds on the radio and runs to the house, and he finds her on the floor, and a paring knife is through her hand, and it's through a note as well that says, you are dead, bitch. And he's like, is she dead? And she's not.
Oh my God.
They take her to the hospital, and Ozzy's like, what do you remember? And she's like, a man came through my gate, came onto the property, and beat me, like hit me over the head with an object, and then I got conked out. But I do remember right before passing out that he injected me with something. And they find a needle mark in her arm, but they can't find anything in her system. And at this point, the police are like, are you doing this? It feels like you're doing this.
Yeah.
We can't. Everything's half done. And it's just hard to understand why you're being assaulted by this same person in this way. That's like,
he's only
stabbing her hand. He has so many opportunities to kill her, and like whoever this person might be, and he's just assaulting her. And And so she's like, I know, I want to figure it out. I'm going to go get hypnotized so you'll believe me. I'm going to take polygraphs so you'll believe me. And she'll do all these things to try to get credibility. But they keep saying she is too traumatized to be a good candidate for any of those things. Like, it's too hard to track.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, her ex is kind of kooky. He's like, I know what it is. It's the mafia. And I have all these reasons for thinking it. And he writes her dad and is like, I figured it out. It's the mafia. Then Ozzy gets called to the house again and finds Heidi has been, like, abused. The dog has been abused.
Okay.
And there's rope around the dog's neck that's the same rope that killed the cats that they found in the yard. He's looking for clues, and on the windowsill of the basement where Heidi's being kept is a cigarette butt, which isn't the kind that Cindy smokes. And this is when he's like, it's not her. Like, she's not hurting her dog. Like, of all the things she might do to herself, she wouldn't hurt that dog.
Right.
She is walking her dog one night and gets attacked by a man with a beard who had a female in his car with him. And a few hours later, she's got a stocking around her neck and she's trying to go into her neighbor's house, totally dazed, totally out of it. And they just find her dog wandering the park. And she's like, I was attacked. And they again find these weird puncture wounds on her arm. Somebody injected her with something. And then she gets put in the hospital, and then somebody weird with an accent calls the hospital that they can't place and is asking about the hospital's security procedures. And they're trying to play the audio for Ozzy. They play it to see if it sounds like make peace, make peace. He's like, I don't know.
That's so crazy to me because it's like, it's just wild to me.
So then during one of these hypnotist sessions, this really feels all over the place, but to give you as much information as possible, I just sort of have to go through it because it's like,
it feels like it's someone who wants her to look crazy, which I think is actually like just it
either feels
thing.
Like that, or it feels like Ruth.
Ruth Finley, yeah.
For where sure, like, where too. Like Cindy is she's doing it to herself, but doesn't know she's doing it to herself. Yeah. And things are too off the wall to sort of follow in the sense that like, her credibility is really hard to track where she goes and gets hypnotized and she's like, oh, I have a repressed memory of witnessing a double murder. All the phone calls she's getting are too short to trace. All these things are happening when no one is around. And with the murder that she witnessed, she's like, it was my ex-husband that did it. He did it with an axe while we were on this vacation. And he took blood from one of the bodies and smeared it on my face and dismembered them. And her sister was with her on that vacation. And she's like, yeah, I don't think that happened. And I didn't notice. Feels like a real stretch. Then she gets involuntarily committed to a psych ward in Vancouver. No. So then she's hospitalized. She's suffering from anorexia and depression. She's not eating. And she is like suicidal. She's like, my life isn't worth living. So she's writing about committing suicide in the hospital, but then they release her after being there for a couple of months. And she's kind of saying like quietly to friends and family, I know who's doing this actually. And it's my ex-husband. And they're like, no, that's not a reveal, Cindy. Like you've been saying that. Do you want us, maybe we should wiretap you and you can have a conversation with him and get him to admit to that, which she then tries to do. And she's like, how about that murder? I remember it came back to me how you murdered those people. And he's like, I did not murder anybody. You have an enormous revenge fantasy that has taken over and I don't know how to talk to you about it. But meanwhile, he's like, it's the mob. I'm like, you guys, So because they're not observing anything, because they're constantly putting time and effort and energy into trying to track this and they're no closer than they were when they started, they're like, we are going to stop surveilling you, but we are going to investigate your claims about this double murder, which of course, like no one went missing at that time or anything. Like, they tried to go to where the murders happened. It's not a place. Like, they couldn't track that.
Yeah.
Then Cindy gets attacked again. And they find her in a ditch wearing a man's work boot and one glove. And she has hypothermia. And again, she has one of those stockings matching the first one that has been tied around her neck. And there will be a lot of stockings, like, lying in the yard. There would, like, the stocking was a theme, mm-hmm. which, again, if you remember Ruth, there was a bandana. It was, like, her imagined assailant had a red bandana, and it would come up again and again, and then they found a red bandana in her stuff when they realized it was her, and then they found out when she was sexually abused as a child by this farmer that he tied her up with a red bandana, that he would stuff a red bandana in her mouth, and, like, that, and that she was, like, 3 years old, and that the repression of that, it turned into a monster with a red bandana.
Yeah.
So that just, it does liken it to that for me, like, with this stalking reappearing over and over again. Then there's these people that live in her house that wake up one night in the basement and they see that it's been lit on fire. So they go to call the police and the phone lines have been cut. And they go to the neighbors and they see a man and they're like, call the fire department, and he runs. So that helps perpetrate the idea that it is an external person doing this and that it could be this person. There's no fingerprints or anything that they can find. They put out the fire. There's no evidence that a person was in the house. So again, the authorities feel like Cindy started the fire. And they're also, like, weirded out that, like, she'll get harmed when she's walking her dog alone at night. And they'll be like, so just to be clear, like, you're being stalked by someone that's threatened you on this level and you're going on, like, night walks alone. It's not totally adding up.
Oy.
She gets examined by a psychologist whose take on it is, you've all been conned by the histrionics of a pretty woman, which we don't love.
Was this a woman psychologist?
Of course not. Okay. Of course not. Come on. A woman would say that?
I just thought I'd make sure. I just wanted to clarify. Jesus Christ.
So we know that Cindy has been accusing her ex-husband of being the person behind this. And then he gets two voicemails on his message machine. And one of them says, Cindy, dead meat soon. And then one of them says, more smack, more downers, another grand after we waste the cunt. No more deal. And so he calls the police right away. Someone is trying to implicate me in this. And they're leaving these crazy voicemails. And then 2 weeks after those voicemails get left, Cindy again gets attacked. They find her in her garage, hogtied, stalking around the neck, naked from the waist down. And they bring in somebody to analyze the knots, an expert mountain climber. And he's like, it's highly unlikely she could have tied these knots. More notes. Sleep well on her windshield. Soon, Cindy, at work. They send dogs to try to find the scent of this person who keeps going into her home. It doesn't work. There we have spent $1.5 million worth of resources trying to figure this out.
Jesus Christ.
Okay. So on May 25th, 1989, at 4 p.m, she goes, she's working still as a nurse at Richmond General Hospital. She goes and picks up her paycheck. She talks to somebody that works there. She's in a good mood. She's like, yeah, nothing's really been going on the last 2 weeks. Nothing scary has happened for me. 2 weeks feels long for Cindy. I didn't give you all the dates on this because I felt like that would have been a little bit agonizing. This has been going on for 6 years. 2 weeks is a long time to have not had an incident. Okay. She leaves with her paycheck. She goes to the supermarket. She goes to the bank. She deposits her paycheck. That same day, she gets an infrared alarm system put into her house.
Mm-hmm.
And that night, her friends are going to come over and play board games with her and spend the night. But then they don't hear from her. And it's 10 o'clock. And they go to her house and the house is locked, but her car's gone. So they're like, okay. They go by the shopping center. They find her car there. It's just abandoned in the shopping center lot. So they go to the police and they report her missing. They go to the car and check it out, and there is some blood on the driver's side door, and there's groceries, and there's a wrapped gift. It's like something happened very suddenly. Her wallet's there. So they're reporting her missing, and then her tenant, like somebody renting from her, calls the police and is like, somebody called this house saying that they were Cindy's father and asking about her life insurance policy. But then they call Cindy's dad, and he's like, I didn't make that call. She's now been missing for several days since May 25th to June 8th. I can't do the math on that, but it's over a week. There's a guy that works paving. Mm-hmm. And he's paving near an abandoned house, and he discovers Cindy's body. And she's been hogtied with a rope. She's in the fetal position. There is one of those black nylon stockings around her neck, and her coat's near her body.
Oh my God.
And the property, even though it's abandoned, is near a really busy intersection. And a lot of people have walked that intersection. It's like a pedestrian intersection. So right away, it's like very bizarre, because it's like, how did this body just sit here and nobody found it for this long? There's a fuel tank nearby, and in orange spray paint, it says, some bitch died here. And then a line from the tank to her body, circling her body. And then inside the abandoned house is the word devil in the same spray paint. Her hands are tied so tightly that it said that one of her fingers had scratched the other one to the bone. It said they found a pinprick that looked again like a hypodermic needle on her elbow. And it said that she had probably begun to decompose at that site maybe as early as June 2nd, 6 days before she was found. They do an autopsy, and they're like, okay, she had a lot of drug intoxication from morphine, diazepam, and flurazepam. She had 10 times the lethal dose of morphine in her bloodstream. So they're like looking at all this, and they're basically like, we think it's suicide. We think it's some kind of suicide or accident, or she thought she'd get discovered. Like, we still believe that she staged this. Mm-hmm. Because of her history with suicidality, because of her history with being a nurse and maybe having access to those drugs, because of a lot of things, they're like, we think that she made up the stalking and that it was like a mental health issue and that she was doing this to herself. And so tabloids hear about that, and that's getting printed. And then Ozzy goes to visit her, goes to whatever, goes to the morgue to examine the body. And he's like, there's lividity on the left side of the body, but her body was found lying on the right. So there's a possibility that she was killed somewhere else.
Yeah.
And then they brought her body there. If she was killed somewhere else, she didn't do that.
No.
An inquest, and there's five jurors that hear a bunch of testimony from 80 witnesses, and they play the messages, those goofy messages on Makepeace's machine. And when he takes the stand, the ex-husband, to defend himself, he's like, by the way, her father sexually abused her all throughout her childhood, and one of her brothers also molested her. And I think the police are trying to frame me because she dated a policeman, and that it just would be like convenient if it were me. And he's like, I don't know if he doesn't reveal this, but it is revealed that they found a bunch of medications in her home, sedatives and antipsychotic drugs in her home. And that when they found them, they flushed them so that they wouldn't be used as part of the trial, because her family was like, somebody did this to her and we don't believe that it was suicide. But then they were like, maybe tampering with evidence. Also, her younger sister found a glass cutter and a syringe and a catheter and saline in her bedroom in her purse.
This is so confusing.
So you're like, she, like a glass cutter, like we know from like incidences where people like were like purported to have broken in. We know that there's all these syringe marks in her arm. That's happened. And then this guy this doctor testifies and is like, I think she had hysterical personality disorder. And somebody else is like, I think she had borderline personality disorder with elements of post-traumatic stress. These people had seen her as a client. And one of them is like, she had so much anger, rage toward her father. And I believe in the ex-husband's allegation that,
yeah,
that there was sexual abuse when she was a child.
Yeah.
Even though she never told me that there was, it's hard for me not to believe that there was based on her rage and now hearing it. So then they're looking into, could she have tied herself up? Again, they're looking at that. They take the same length of nylon that was tying the knots that bound her, and they give it to a knot expert, and he demonstrates how she could have bound herself, which he has to do in 3 minutes because they have to prove that if she took that amount of narcotics,
that's how she could have
then take it and then tie herself. And how does that work? In May of 1990, 1 year after that she had been reported missing or disappeared, they're unable to make a determination of suicide, homicide, or accidental. And so they rule that she died of an unknown event and they close the case.
Oh my God.
And even her ex-husband now says that he's come to a place where he's like, I think she had multiple personalities. And I do believe that she was the perpetrator and that she did this to herself. I don't think she would have harmed her dog willingly. I don't think she would have done this to herself and scared her parents, like done this to them. Like, she was harming people she wouldn't have harmed, but I think she had multiple personalities and didn't know she was doing it.
That's
the Cindy James case. And if you like go into it, it's one of those like things where you'll just go onto Reddit for like 6 hours and just lose a day because so many people know so many different things, or like bring up like if this, then this, or like how explain this. And it's that vibe of like, there feels like there's a lot of little things that you're like, it does feel like it had to be somebody else that killed her. Right. And then like my head is like, did she hire someone to kill her?
Right.
Not knowing that she was doing it. Like, how far did this go? Because it, again, I thought that Ruth Finley was such a once in a lifetime story because it's so strange. It's easier for me to believe that she's not, and that if you are sexually abused as a child, it can break you as a coping mechanism where the only way to move forward is to move forward with your mind fractured in this way.
Yeah.
And that
we know the abuse, that we know the evidence of the brains of child sexual abuse survivors is, I mean, it's worse than a Vietnam War veteran brain. Like, if you look at it, the amount of damage that causes a person is insane, for lack of a better word. It's really intense.
It's so upsetting. So for me, the black nylon stocking is the red bandana. And it feels like to understand Cindy James's case, you need to understand Ruth Finley's. And I don't mean to like totally conflate them, but I wouldn't be surprised
I get what you're saying.
I just wouldn't be surprised if Cindy James's dad, there's some memory of like black nylon stocking being something she saw or was used on her at some point as a child. And she's personifying this villain that she'll be afraid of forever. She'll be afraid of in death. And I don't think that there's a part of her. I really believe that she believed herself.
Yeah.
And I really believed she didn't
intend
to mislead.
Ugh. If someone did hurt her, what a devastating.
Also, like the gaslighting nature of like, but I think that's why the story is so disturbing as well.
Yeah.
Is that we're left not knowing and we're left we're left with this sinking feeling of our own culpability in this, where I tell this story and I think we all don't believe her at certain moments. And then we have this nagging feeling of, but what if?
Yeah.
And wouldn't that be the worst nightmare to live of all? Yeah. Is to be going through this and be completely alone and keep being brought to the brink of death so many times and torture and have no one believe you. Or even the people that do believe you, you can see that nagging suspicion behind their eyes, you know?
No, that's torture.
Anyway, wow. That's the story of Cindy James. And I'm sorry I presented it in such a disorganized way. There's so many incidences and incidi that I had to trim a little, and I had to be like, list of facts, because it's an epic case.
That's an epic case. All right.
90 times she called the police.
That poor woman. I just, even if someone is creating that, I mean, also the other thing is like the person who's hurting someone is hurting themselves. They're not. And I think like, regardless if she's knows what she's doing, it like the poor woman, like she stabbed herself with a paring knife. Who's winning? No one. Okay. Thank you for sharing that story. Should we hang up and record another one?
Yes.
Or should we stop? Dear listeners, dear readers, love you. Quinn, love you. I'm going to be in Canada. So
fun. I'm so excited for you. I can't wait to hear about it.
I also wanted to tell you two things. I'm going to talk about it later, but if I want to give a shout out, my cousin Becky had her baby.
Happy baby. She's so cute.
I'll talk to you more about it next episode, because it deserves more than shout out. I love.
Yeah, that's really exciting.
It's really good stuff. Okay. Mwah, goodbye. I love you all.
Bye.